number one.
So that's who I am, and you'll just have to look without the name tag. Toby Pingree, who is the current chair of the Sunstone Board, would like to take just a couple of minutes to make a few comments, and then I'll introduce our speaker for the evening. Toby.
It's good to be back in Northern California again. I lived down here for 25 years over in Walnut Creek, and I was reminded that I was a bishop over there in the Singles Ward for about 10 years, and it's where a lot of wonderful things happened to me and my family. I moved to Salt Lake, one of those expatriates that sort of went back home to Salt Lake about 4 years ago, and that's where my wife and I reside. And I've been involved with the Sunstone Board for about a year and a half now. We appreciate the efforts of Janet, of Richard, and the others who put together the symposium this evening. It's a wonderful program. They've worked hard to get people on it that I think represent some wonderful ideas and things to talk about. And I look forward to it. On the national level, we've had some difficulties and trials ourselves with Sunstone getting magazines out, and I think we've taken some positive steps that are going to show up with magazines coming out in the future. Tomorrow you get a chance to talk to Dan Witherspoon, who's the new editor, and he can tell you where we are, particularly with specific magazines. But we've worked hard on the website that's going to be up shortly, and have the symposium for this summer in Salt Lake well underway. We appreciate your support. I can't have to mention that we could not survive without the support of people who are willing to share their resources to Sunstone survives. It can't do it alone with just the magazines and symposium fees. So please be generous with your contributions. There's been something that has come up between the preliminary program and where we are tonight that I think is caused some concern, and I've sort of prepared a statement here, and it relates to something that's in the program, and anyway, I'll read that, and afterwards I'll talk to you about anything about it if you'd like to, but let me go as forward. I felt I had to write it because I'm not sure I could have done it well otherwise, but it's probably not news to some of you that there's been a significant amount of controversy regarding a paper that was scheduled for presentation at this symposium. The paper proposed by Cindy Lefevre was listed as The Hidden Nazi Mentality and the Proclamation on the Family in the Preliminary Program. The abstract description that followed indicated the paper would draw striking and disturbing parallels between the situation of Jews in 20th century Germany and that of homosexuals in the LDS Church today by examining the values, mindset, and events that enticed a society to commit heinous hate crimes and eventually the final solution, then comparing them to contemporary LDS values. That's out of the abstract. Most of those I spoke to regarding this proposed paper were really surprised that Sunstone would consider sponsoring a presentation that appeared to lump the Proclamation of the Family with the programs worked by perpetrators of the Holocaust. Such a direct attack was totally out of harmony with the purpose of the organization to attack neither religious organizations nor individuals. It would also run contrary to a stated goal of not allowing presentations that would generate hostility and anger. Had the Sunstone review process functioned properly, this proposal would not have been in the preliminary program as it was listed. Proper review certainly would have resulted in a different title for the paper. A careful review of the content might have determined as well that the paper did not measure up the standards we try to maintain and would have been deleted from the program. Unfortunately, we goofed by not adequately following the review process we ascribed to, and our standard operating procedures for many academic literary efforts. Then came the hard part, what to do about it. A significant portion of the Sunstone community and formal organization argued that offensive title and negative destructive tenor of the abstract were justification for excising the paper from the program. Some of this persuasion were also fearful that even consideration of such a paper could cause the church to take some significant action against Symposium in general or Sunstone in particular. There was concern that many church moderates sympathetic to Sunstone would move from supporting the organization. On the other side, there were those who feared that striking the paper from the program would be a violation of Sunstone's expressed purpose to provide a forum for all points of view that were respectfully presented in a well-documented and reasoned manner. would we be catering to those who might want to push Sunstone to be more like a correlated church publication? Were we letting the fear of reprisal determine the extent to which we would honor our open discussion inquiry? After much discussion, much, with those of both persuasions, consideration of many alternative courses of action, we have arrived at a Solomonic conclusion that will probably leave many on both sides dissatisfied, but comes close to honoring both our commitments to maintain a forum for open expression of diverse points of view, while affirming that there are boundaries to which that are appropriate for Sunstone. Cindy should have the opportunity to present her paper if she chooses to do so. She has expended effort to prepare it and are allowing its inclusion in the preliminary program put the world on notice of its existence. However, we of the Sunstone Board take the stand that the paper is not appropriate for the Sun Symposium program because of the way it was originally characterized, as well as the current content of the paper. Hence, it was decided not to include it as the part of the symposium as the official program indicates. If Cindy wishes to present her paper, the space is available as had been originally scheduled from 11 a.m. to 11:45 tomorrow. But there will be a session outside the Sunstone program and sponsorship. Those who wish to attend her presentation, respond to it, are encouraged to do so. I wish you well this evening, Kelly.
So as you can see, Sunstone is not without its controversies. And on behalf of Richard and myself, our stand on this has been that we are 100% behind Cindy on presenting this paper. So we hope that you'll join her tomorrow, if you feel so inclined. Toby, you took my program. That's my notes. Thank you. Really, in all honesty, our speaker tonight does not need any introduction. However, I'm going to take just a moment because I think if we all sat back and thought about it for a little bit, we'd all realize that we all have what we could effectively call a Carolyn Pearson moment. Now, I could claim that my Carolyn Pearson moment is that before Carolyn moved to California, I actually went to school with Carolyn's daughter, Emily. And in fact, I'm a little older and wiser now, so I guess I can confess this, but Carolyn and I, or Emily and I, were best enemies. And I say that because Emily and I have the same best friend. And when you're a child, you become very territorial, and you can't share best friends. So Emily and I had the same best friend, but we weren't necessarily best friends. However, I have watched with interest Emily's mother's career, and I have wondered over the years, as I've grown a little older and a little wiser, how Emily was and progressed, and I've certainly had conversations with you in the past about that. But that's not even my Carolyn Pearson moment. My real Carolyn Pearson moment, I think, is a moment that all of the rest of you have probably had as well. I don't think there's a person in this room who perhaps has not been moved by something that Carolyn has said to them personally in meeting her, perhaps not been moved by something that they've read or something that they heard read that Carolyn wrote or that someone shared. And so tonight I think we're very honored to have in our midst, I think, one of the most dynamic, interesting, mythical and mystical women in Mormonism, and that is Carolyn Pearson.
Thank you so much, Janet. I really do appreciate being invited to speak with you this evening. It's great to see so many that I get to see not often enough. As always, I need to start out with a couple of jokes. I am an adapter, maker-up of, and collector of Mormon jokes, and one day I'll have a little volume out, I tell myself. I'm sure some of you have heard a few of these. Let me try to find a couple that maybe you wouldn't mind hearing again. Okay, here's one of my favorites that I adapted from a good Jewish joke. Isn't that funny already? Wow. All right. We are hungry tonight. Do you know the only acceptable Mormon wine? Oh, can't we move back to Utah? And you know why Mormon women stop having babies at 40? Because 41 is too many. Oh, dear. Did you know that the Catholics don't recognize divorce, and Jewish people don't recognize Christmas, and Mormons don't recognize each other at the grocery store on Sunday? Now, this next little bit is not a joke. In fact, that is the way that Susan told me on the telephone the other day. She said, this is not a joke, but do you know? And since then, several other people have told me, Susan, so this is true. And this leads us into the subject, so please pay attention. You know, the unfortunate situation of our airplane and the Chinese plane and the Chinese pilot that was unfortunately killed there. Do you know his name? Really, what? This is true. This is true. His name was Wang Wei. Now, Cindy will forgive you for laughing at that. And I laughed at that when Susan told me because, I mean, it's a terrible, dreadful, awful thing. And yet, we are tickled whenever we find this phenomenon that we're about to call synchronicity right now. We love to see connections. It just really interests us to see how things come. You remember a few years ago when I think there was even a pop song that capitalized on that whole line of things with President Kennedy and President Lincoln, and Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy, and Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln, and there were just, you know, like a dozen major. Well, we love that stuff, don't we? We're really drawn to it because in this world of chaos, we love to find some kind of order, which does indeed bring us to my subject of this evening, and I'm really excited to talk about this subject because it's been truly the lens through which I have examined my life for the last several years. I remember my husband quoting, and I do not know where this came from, all religion begins in mysticism and ends in politics. Well, I won't touch the last part of that sentence, but the first part we know to be true. Our religion began in this splendid moment of mysticism, and we have all of the canonized and correlated stuff now, the visions, the revelations, the Urim and Thummim, and all those things that we're very proud of and talk about in Sunday school. And then we have the less respectable stuff, the magic, the money digging, the masonry, astrology, the phrenology. I know that Joseph Smith was wearing a Jupiter talisman at the time of his death, and I know he had the bumps on his head read from a phrenologist. We don't really talk about the term synchronicity, but clearly it was what Joseph Smith had in mind when, in his journal entry for April 3rd, 1833, he tied the date of April 6th to the creation of the earth, the birth of Christ, the death of Christ, the Passover, and the restoration of the church. So, patterns, meaningful coincidences. A couple of weeks ago, Elaine Cannon handed me this little book. She and I were over across the street from priesthood meeting at Deseret Book, Ladies Night, signing books. And she signed for me and handed me this little book, Big Ideas About Love. And as I looked at the first page, she's talking about the word love. And it says, significantly, L occupies the 12th position in the English alphabet. And 12 is the age of the boy Jesus in the temple, as well as the number of apostles he taught that love is the first and great commandment, that God is love. And I thought, well, she's looking for patterns, looking for synchronicity. I think all of us enjoy doing that. Now, my next little story here has nothing to do with where I'm going to take you this evening. But as I was sitting there with Elaine and some of the, and here was Chieko down there, and Barbara Smith here, and I went down the hall to the ladies' room. Now, keep in mind that we were doing all this while priesthood is in session, and then priesthood meeting's over and all the men come. So I come back from the hallway and I say to Barbara Smith, I said, Barbara, listen, if you want to see something you'll never see again in your whole life, just go down the hallway there. There is nobody at the ladies' room and a long line at the men's room. I ordinarily like just to speak and not to read. I'm going to make a partial shift in that tonight, because so much of what I want to say to you, I have now written into a book that I know will be published, but it is going to be a long process. And I need to get the right publisher, and I think it's not going to happen instantly. At the moment, I'm calling this message from the universe a personal journey in meaningful coincidence. I plan to get a good and catchy and more commercial title, but that is what I'm working with at the moment. I believe I want just to read to you the introduction and the first section. And then I want to just tell, and perhaps read also a few of the synchronistic stories that appear in this manuscript. I offer this book with the excitement of a child who runs in from a morning at the creek holding something in her hand. She doesn't know exactly what she found, but she knows it is so unusual, so beautiful, so intriguing that she has to say, "Look, look." She runs to the field where her playmates are and shares the discovery in an innocent and awesome show and tell. What I hold in my hand is something I have been searching for all my life. A little personal piece of cosmic wonder that I can stare at and say, "Ah, a bit of evidence. There is something going on backstage. There is somebody driving the bus. There is a pattern on the underside of this quilt." Never mind the mixing of my metaphors. That happens when I'm excited. I have lived my life by faith, choosing to believe that life has to make sense, choosing to believe there is an unseen world that we are connected to and offers guidance as needed, choosing to believe there is spirit behind matter, choosing to believe consciousness survives death, choosing to believe there is a God and God is good, always a conscious choice made in faith. I remember the day in my 20s when I wrote a simple little verse sitting on the rocks of the Aegean Sea on the shore of the Greek island of Mykonos. Blue of water meeting blue of sky, pelicans, fishing boats, windmills, tiny whitewashed churches, peace. I know only as much of God and the world as a creature with two eyes must. But what I do understand, I love. And what I don't understand, I trust. Trust is how I have lived my life. But always, always there has been that hunger to know, to see, to experience the unseen world. I have been a mystic with nothing in my poor little cup but trust. How come some have held out their cup and received visions, voices, revelations, appearances from deceased loved ones, angelic encounters, astonishing answers to prayers, big, big things to fill their mystical cup, while trust rattled around in mine? I had pretty much given up. Not on life, not on trust. Just given up on the idea that I would ever experience the mystical. I was resigned, fairly happily resigned, just to sit at the table of my cosmological kitchen, sipping the bit of warmth my little cup offered, still keeping one eye on the front door in case, just in case it ever opened and my hoped-for vision or voice or angelic encounter burst in. I know my metaphors are hopelessly mixed, but I'm still excited. Now, here's the good part. While I was eyeing the front door, the seemingly locked and bolted front door, something snuck in the back door. Snuck in very quietly and tiptoed up to the table, just waiting for me to turn around and notice it. Guest and host at the same time, and yes, yes, filling my cup, filling my little cup to overflowing. Phenomenon has a name. Psychologist Carl Jung, that was Brigham's brother, for some of you who do not know. Carl Jung was the one who brought the word into our vocabulary. Synchronicity. Meaningful coincidence. A moment in which the outer world of matter and the inner world of feeling merge together and something new is born. You can read the scientists and the psychologists for descriptions and objective information. Carl Jung. My example concerns a young woman patient who proved to be psychologically inaccessible. I was sitting opposite her one day with my back to the window, listening to her flow of rhetoric. She had had an impressive dream the night before in which someone had given her a golden scarab, a costly piece of jewelry. While she was still telling this dream, I heard something behind me gently tapping on the window. I turned around and saw that it was a fairly large flying insect that was knocking against the window pane from the outside in the obvious effort to get into the dark room. It seemed to me very strange. I opened the window immediately and caught the insect in the air as it flew in. It was a scarab-eyed beetle. I handed this beetle to my patient with the words, "Here is your scarab." This experience punctured the desired hole in her rationalism and broke the ice of her intellectual resistance. The treatment could now be continued with satisfactory results. And Jung goes on, "My experiences of the phenomenon of synchronicity have multiplied themselves over the decades." And now from Jean Shinoda Bolen. Synchronicity suggests that the outer world really does reflect the inner world, not just that it seems to. With the idea of synchronicity, psychology joined hands with parapsychology and theoretical physics in seeing an underlying something akin to what the mystic has been seeing all along. From Deepak Chopra. According to Vedanta, Hindu teaching, there are only two symptoms of enlightenment. The first symptom is that you stop worrying. Things don't bother you anymore. The second symptom is that you encounter more and more meaningful coincidences in your life, more and more synchronicities. And this accelerates to the point where you actually experience the miraculous. Maybe some of you saw Deepak this afternoon on Rosie's show. I, last fall, attended a seminar from Deepak Chopra, 4.5 days of just 30 people with him, entitled Synchrodestiny, Using Synchronicity to Create the Life That You Want. It was a very, very thrilling seminar. And I'm now quoting Eloise Bell. Okay, not a scientist, just one of my smart friends, from an email. Just had a thought. If we are one and time is one, then synchronicity is nothing more nor less than reality coming increasingly into focus in our lives and spirits. All is synchronicity in the end, no? What I bring to the table is my own little mystical cup, now a treasure trove, overflowing with synchronicities, carefully tracked and examined for personal meaning. One person's journey in inviting and experiencing virtually daily meaningful coincidences. I began keeping a diary when I was a senior in high school, fall of 1956. I now have a huge shelf of handwritten books, and as of tonight, well, let me peek, 4,185 pages that are single-spaced from typewriter or computer. 46 years worth of recording my life and probing it for meaning. It was about 3 years ago that I began to describe events through a lens that I called messages from the universe. Something just happened to happen during the day that looked like a dramatization of the inner script of my psyche. I had for decades tracked my nighttime dreams and tried to tease meaning from them. But now I saw myself tracking what Jean Bolen calls a dream that happens to you when you are awake. If there were messages coming in from the universe, from God, from my higher self, I didn't want to miss them. I paid attention. I studied. I found the word synchronicity. Leonardo da Vinci said that much of his creativity came from the fact that he looked for the hidden meaning behind every event in his life. I now look at everything that happens to me and say, this event were a metaphor in the poem of my life, what might it mean? What are the layers of richness and insight that might be behind this synchronistic symbol? This lens brings an interesting clarity not only to today's events, but to events that have stuck in my mind from the past. Ah, synchronicity. That's how I can explain the delicious evening I spent with the man I loved in college when both of our watches stopped. And yet meeting that same man on his honeymoon in New York City twice, both having come there from thousands of miles in different directions. And, oh yes, my youngest daughter, Katie, starting her first menstrual period when I was having my final one. I always accused her of stealing my periods. And, yes, that day when I was writing in my diary and nearly going up in smoke with outrage, and the underlined feature of my computer kept coming on all by itself. This thing and that thing, they look different now. They look connected, meaningful, as does the whole landscape of my life, seen now through a new lens. A word of caution. A friend of mine who is manic depressive tells me she cannot do synchronicity because it makes her lose her balance and go nutty. Any of us can go nutty, I think, if we look for omens and follow them willy-nilly. I've come now to ask myself if my synchronicities are suggesting not only insight but action, and there are many things I've done as a result of answering yes, but I would never do anything because of a synchronicity unless the action also passed the test of good judgment and was in harmony with the same inner spirit I have listened to all my life. Every story we'll read in the following pages is true, et cetera, et cetera. A little disclaimer here. And now back to trust. Trust is the ultimate message from the universe that is whispered or occasionally shouted in my ear as I open the daily notes that are delivered through synchronicity. Nothing frightening, always encouraging, sometimes hilarious, frequently mysterious, always fascinating. We are one, and we are progressing toward enlightenment. More than ever before, the universe has my attention and my gratitude. This next section gives the large, large picture that I look at to see my life. But I'm going to take just a little break from reading that and just tell you a couple of very recent synchronicities that have been written so far only in my diary. These that are written in the book, and there are about 55 stories that now have been written here. They're all specific instances. Yesterday morning, one that happened last week. This book at this moment is in the hands of the agent of Deepak Chopra. I was able to get him to recommend me to his agent. And so I sent her first a sampling of the sections, asking if I may send her the whole thing. And to shorten this comedy of errors, she expressed interest in what she had seen, and then I sent the full thing, which she did not get. So for the last 7 weeks, she has been looking only at the little small samples, while I thought she was examining the whole entire piece. So we had a conversation on the phone last week, her, for whatever reason, believing I was wanting only to publish these few little samples, and me believing she had the whole thing. We'd never have even known we were talking about the different animals had she not said, well, it's also a very short book, you know. I said, well, 150 pages. I haven't seen 250. So, okay, that was the big event of that day. Of course, I was just so stunned at the stupidity of whatever happened along that to have me lost. And so on that day, and believe me when I tell you that it is almost every day that I have something that grabs my attention so clearly that I know I am being given by whom? My higher self, God, the universe, what I call now a synchronicity. Okay, so I leave that conversation. And I go to give blood, which I always do every 8 weeks when they call me. And I have, you know, that little first test where they prick your finger to see how your iron is doing. And she got my little drop and said, ooh, you just barely made it. It was a 38. If you were a little bit lower than that, we'd be able to take you. And I said, well, you know, in all my years of giving blood, I have only been turned away once from an iron deficiency. So I go in, and I'm sitting there in the chair with my feet up, needle in my arm, red stuff flowing out of my veins. Then I open my purse, and I want to read this little book that I brought with me. It's a very humorous book called Duck Soup for the Soul by Swami Vyandananda. It's very, very funny. So I open and I read on page 44, are you suffering from an irony deficiency? We have in our diet today much more irony than ever before, because so many of us, even professional comedians, fail to be able to process all this irony in their lives. So, you know, within minutes, I have these two things. Okay, this is my message for today. Have I had an irony today? Oh, well, yes, I think so. Now, I leave to go from there to my chiropractor, and I'm lying there. She's telling me about her daughter has a job, and a new job she likes, but she hates she has to wear a professional dress, and she hates to iron. And I say, with my face smashed into the little table, oh, she suffers from ironing deficiency. So that seems to me, okay, three different places I had this thing. Irony. Okay, the message to me is, as Swami Vyandananda insisted, laugh. Just see the irony and laugh. So that was my good synchronicity for that day. All right, now here's yesterday morning. The night before, I had really gone to bed saying for the first time in I don't know how long, can't identify a synchronicity today. That's interesting. Oh, well, I'm a bad person. Just, okay, so. But yesterday morning, as I was out for my walk, and here's where I do a lot of all this processing, I thought, oh, wow, that is interesting. So the event that had happened the day before, and see, I wasn't sure how fast I was going to have to race to get here because I was supposed to go to jury duty on Wednesday. And, you know, you can never predict if they're going to let you go, if you're going to have to be there for the rest of the week, even the next week, who knows. So Tuesday night, I had to call in to see my group, number 7, and they said, groups, don't report in the morning, call back on at noon to find out if you will be required for the afternoon. So I thought, oh, wow, I get a morning free. Terrific. So I get busy doing my stuff, call in at noon, and I hear the voice say, groups, 4, 6, 7, that's me, da-da-da-da-da, you'll be glad to know that you are not needed, your jury duty is at an end, do not report or call again. And I was so excited. I went into ecstasy. I played the message again because I loved it to hear what she was saying so much. It just thrilled me. So I remember I just sat there and I went, whee! I felt like I had just been given 3 new days into my life. Now, wouldn't that be exciting to be given? I mean, we think it's great to get 1 hour, you know, at the end of, you know, in the fall when we get to change our clocks and get 1 hour. So here I had, it was just thrilling. I've been released from jury duty. So yesterday morning, as I was thinking about this, I thought, oh, yeah, and what happened before that? Okay, yeah. There were 2 things that I now see are kind of interesting there. Okay, let's talk about judgment. I humbly pride myself on being a fairly non-judgmental person, and I think I have a fair amount of tolerance for a wide variety of people. I find myself sometimes, well, of course, I judge. We all judge people. This is not right. That is not right. I judge people for judging. And that particular morning, before I was released from jury duty, I had had 2 experiences in which I was watching a videotape of Greg Braden, one of the New Age gurus, as I was doing my weights, which I had to have something to take my mind off it. And he was talking about, you know, complete not judging, to consider that what if every moment in its own way is perfect. And so I'm arguing. I say, now, Greg, come on. What about O.J.? You know, what about Hitler? You know, what about... So I have that little argument with him. Later on, I get an email from Lane, this friend in our ward, and he's giving this silly thing, a list of things that wives were to do for their husbands that it came like from the 40s or maybe even before that, that was really so embarrassing. And he started out by saying, this is really funny, but in a way it's sad. But in another way, we just shouldn't judge these people for what they were thinking back then. So I think, now, come on, Lane, come on, we've got to judge them. You know, if we don't know, blah, 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 blah. So that particular morning, I found myself on two occasions judging people for asking me not to judge, as I so often judge people for judging. I'm right there all the time. And so I think, okay, I think in some way every day of my life I show up for jury duty and I plaster that badge on me and I say, here I am, and I take notes and I listen very carefully because it's up to me to judge. And so I'm thinking as I'm walking yesterday, what is the symbolic meaning behind my being dismissed from jury duty on this morning when I had spent some bit of energy judging people for not judging, or you often judging people for judging, and always judging events of my life and events of your life? Is it possible I could feel that ecstatic thrill that I felt when I heard that woman's voice say, do not report for jury duty. You are through. You are dismissed. And then I thought, oh, yeah, I have heard hi, this is Jesus. Do not judge. You are dismissed from jury duty. Could I possibly feel the ecstasy if I ever accepted that in true face value to say, I am not called to the jury? I do not have to judge. I don't have to judge your judgment or your lack of judgment. Oh, and then later on yesterday, I got this email from Deepak's organization saying, every morning, try to look at the events of your life without judgment as the day goes along. I am committed through that and through many other experiences I have about judging to, of course, try to be discerning about how I interrelate the world, what I give, what I take. But other than that, just look on it with interest and say, I'm so glad I'm not on jury duty. I can't wait to write that one up. That'll be fun. That'll be fun, won't it? Okay. The big relief, the big comfort that working with synchronicity gives me is the promise that the story of my life has observable meaning. I pull back for the long shot and see the formation of plot and theme. Down here, walking the earth, I can't see the forest for the trees. I can't see the drama for the actors. But up above in my spiritual helicopter, I can see both the small event and the larger pattern. Just as I remember where I was when I heard that President Kennedy was shot, I remember where I was when I first heard about fractals. I was on an airplane flying from the East Coast back to my home in California, and an article by Margaret Wheatley, well known for her writings on chaos theory, caught my attention with a subheading, "The order inherent in chaos can guide both individuals and organizations." And the photographs, I couldn't believe my eyes. I assailed a couple of people across the aisle and said, look at this. Do you know anything about fractals? I know I should do this for the warmer, but I did it for fractals. First, the initial fractal, a beautiful computer-generated design, then the same pattern magnified 265 times, then 1 million, a billion, 40 billion, 1 trillion, each of them perfect, clear variations that held the original design. One of the most astonishing characteristics of fractals is their property of self-similarity. There is pattern within pattern within pattern. There is no end to them, no scale small enough that these intricate shapes cease to form. Looking deep into a fractal is an experience of looking into infinity. I read about quantum physics. about the discovery of a holographic universe that is more thought than thing, about the part being in the whole and the whole in the part. I don't really get it, but I know there is truth there. Is my body a hologram of the universe? Is my spirit a hologram of God? I've almost had taken to singing, I am a hologram of God. Isn't that good? Yeah? The part is in the whole, and the whole is in the part. Pattern within pattern within pattern. Here is what I do get. My life is not a random series of unrelated events. A magnet of meaning is attracting this thing, that thing, the other thing, this person, that person. As with fractals, the events of my life have a property of self-similarity, and the parts reflect the whole. I yearn to see the whole. I propel my spiritual helicopter up and up and up as high as it will go. Dear God, I want to see so many clouds. So pathetic, my little vehicle putting away up where the air is thin. But I look down and I glimpse what? Pattern within pattern within pattern. I glimpse synchronicity. I have a fantasy that before I came to this earth, I sat down with my spiritual committee to plan this mortal adventure. Okay, Carolyn, the head of my committee says, we'll assume I've had that name forever, and also that I've been female forever, and we won't get into that, any of you. What are your goals for this field trip? Let's see, where are you in your eternal development? We look into the great crystal to see my history. Ever since I evolved out of that awesome primordial soup of intelligence to individuate as something that became me, I had been learning and growing and experiencing for eons on my journey toward godness. The major theme was to become love, only love, but there were sub-themes to move me along the way to my divine destination, particular lessons marking my progress. Step by step, experience by experience, virtue by virtue, I progressed along the eternal round of time and timelessness. And here I was in the year of our Lord, 1939, preparing to go to the physical for a next very large adventure. I think I know what I need to specialize in, I say, observing the strong places and the weak places in the history of my learning. I am saying this because I don't believe I'm a victim here or over there. I think an important theme for this field trip, I sigh knowing this is not going to be a picnic, is something about gender, something about being a woman. The bending path was becoming clear now, fog lifting. Yes, a major theme is going to be, let's call it, how to validate femaleness in a world that does not validate femaleness. Ah, my committee says in unison, very interesting. And coincidentally, says my committee head, very pleased, look how that fits the flow of history, the needs of the earth. You can learn what you need to, and if you do well, you can teach a thing or two. And remember, here he, she goes off onto a wild explanation of the nature of the hologram, that the whole is in the part, and that if I accomplish this task inside of myself, the success will resonate into the whole human family. I didn't get it then, and I don't get it now, but I know there is something. All right, I exclaim, getting really excited now. Let's set it up the big obstacle course. This I knew was the way it was done, coming up against the challenges that leads to understanding, that leads to joy. And I also knew that, after all, I am that I might have joy. Ideas began to fly fast and furious. First of all, it's pretty enlightened down there still about gender issues, and we'll send you down with an already developed feminist consciousness. That'll be very confusing. Oh, that's good, I say. And you've got to go to a really intense patriarchy. No, not the Taliban in Afghanistan. It's some nice people, either the Pope in Rome or the Prophet in Salt Lake City. Ah, the Mormons, chimes in another. She will love the Mormons. And the patriarchy will drive her to drink, except that they don't drink. And let's see, how about an ancestral lineage that totally devoid of qualities that are considered feminine? And will take away her mother at an early age. That will leave with no real role model. Oh, good. put in some older brothers who can teach her nothing, and a younger sister that she won't be able to teach squat about being a woman. Female that's being bruised and battered, but it was still breathing. I know there's something else, something big. My committee members look at each other blankly. How about no man ever falls in love with her? Ouch, I say, but something worse than that. I want to go the whole distance. Well, says my committee head reluctantly, there is something that would shred any possible remaining esteem for your femaleness, but I hate to bring it on, I demand. Well, how about marriage, yes, but marriage to a homosexual man? Bingo, I shout in delight. But Carolyn, bring it on! You may have laughed at that. I did. In blueprint form, the big obstacle course must be viewed dispassionately. Future anguish doesn't matter. Yet. But when spiritual creation is born into matter, then it matters. Cell by cell. Future anguish doesn't matter. Yet. But when spiritual creation is born into matter, then it matters. Cell by cell, within the matter of my mother, I manifested. The energy was me dancing along that magical line between particle and wave, choosing the particle, the particle, the particle, forgetting the wave, forgetting the vastness from which I had come, forgetting that within the particle was the whole. Cell by cell, exploding within my mother into matter, matter, density, details. 1939, I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, embraced by an encouraging, caring community, proudly learning the stories of my grandmother, Sarah, who walked across the plains at age 8 as a Mormon pioneer, singing, I am a child of God and he has sent me here, aware somehow, even as a child, that God's maleness meant that my femaleness was secondary. I won't read all of this. I go on to detail much of my life that you know about. And then a little section on, well, how am I doing with this assignment that I accepted? And all along the way, that wonderful running thread of meaning, synchronicity, chaos into order, pattern within pattern within pattern. From my high and hovering place, I look over onto your territory. Barely, barely I see markers, plot points on the path, a pattern forming. I cannot read it, but I believe that you can. So I will challenge each one of you as you leave this evening to spend a few minutes tonight, or as you're driving, or as you sit there at your diary, try to get up into your own spiritual helicopter and look at the large lay of the land of your life and see what patterns repeat. Look and see, okay, if you're a novelist, what's the theme of this story that's in front of me here? What is the theme that I can ascertain because of the plot points that have the same kind of stuff going on in them? I'm sure that sometime in your life you've said, oh, wow, not that again. Or, oh, I thought I was through with that. Or, mm. Now, I remember writing in Goodbye, I Love You. Now, not only, how do I put it? Seemingly God, certainly my church, and now my husband all prefer men. Well, that's a pretty unmistakable theme. And as I investigate that theme, it is not only fascinating, but it's very, very comforting to say, wow, I can do any of this stuff if there's meaning in it. So meaning is what I am looking for every day as I keep my eyes open and my ears open to see what is intersecting in front of me. What words come together? You know, as I'm reading something, as the TV is on, a word often. I'm sure that many of you are aware of some of this stuff. I encourage you to be more aware of it. And then to ask yourself, you know, without being really foolish, say, wow, if this were a metaphor, or if the universe is asking me to look at this word, or asking me to look at whatever it is that these two things, as they bump into each other, what does that bring up for me? Just kind of free flow with it, as if you're doing active imagination following a dream. And these are so private. I mean, I am totally the owner of all of my synchronicities. The hundreds, I'm sure there are a couple of thousand now that I have written down in my diary, tiny ones and bigger ones. I am the sole proprietor of my synchronicities, as you are of yours and of your dreams. And we are the only ones who can say, ooh, to me, I think this might have meaning in this direction. So let me share with you some of the specific stories now that make up the body of this book. And I'm going to choose a few that have to do more specifically with life in the church. And yet this book has a very strong Mormon context. Let me tell you about my monks. No, Mormons don't have monks, as you know, but Tibetan Buddhists do have monks. And I think I'll save time if I just tell you about some of these rather than reading them. Would you rather hear me tell them or read them? Tell them, yeah. Okay, a couple of years ago, my friend Susan Randall, right there, called me and said, did you read, we received the Unity Church's newsletter. She said, did you know that they're having some Tibetan monks come and they need housing for them? I wonder if we could, I'm thinking about doing that. And so I thought, wow, I'd like to house a couple of monks. So I called down to the Unity Center and I said, I want to apply for some of your monks. Now, they already knew me. I performed my play in their sanctuary, so they might trust me with a couple of their monks. But they were rapidly running out of monks. And they said, I think we might have assigned them all. There were only about 12. And so I was disappointed. Oh, dear, no, they were all out of monks. She said, well, there's a place that might not be able to take them, so I'll call you back. So anyway, she hung back the next morning and said, good news, Carolyn, I can give you two monks. Oh, yay, I got my monks. All right, so I had these two charming young men for a week, Atin and Jean-Paul. They were there to give presentations and to design this gorgeous sand painting mandala, and also to do the climax of the week was a big performance at the Regional Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek to raise for Tibetan causes and to show Tibetan history. So I had a fine time with these two monks who, in fact, one time chastised me for wiping the ants off my counter. No, too much killing. However, when I took them out to get some videos to watch in their spare time, they chose Jackie Chan and Sylvester Stallone. I thought, come on, you guys. Okay, so anyway, we did have a fine time. So that was that week. At the end of that week, on Friday night, on Friday during the day, these are the two things that happened. I attended the wedding of a niece in the Oakland Temple. Now, I know we have to be very careful about talking about anything about the temple, and I am not talking about anything that ought not to be talked about. This is purely a technicality, and in fact, it turns out to be a criticism of me and not of the temple, so please relax. Okay. We're there in the beautiful, beautiful sealing room. Beautiful bride, fine-looking groom come in, and I see these tags on them, the blue tags, to be married, paper tags, pinned in. And I remember when I got married, it said, to be married immediately. And so I'm here 2 years ago in the skinny room, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. And every time I've been, you know, I go on jury duty. Every time I sit there in the room looking at the beauty of the event and looking at these silly name tags, and I thought, gee, why can't we do better than that? We spend millions on the aesthetics of this building. Why, when, you know, just outside the door, the temple worker could just take off this tag, and now that they know that they won't marry accidentally the wrong bride, the wrong groom, and, you know, just... So anyway, I'm just sitting there saying, somebody ought to do something. I ought to just go up there and take the tags off. Of course, I didn't, but I was on jury duty again, and I... So I'm thinking, you know, somebody ought to write a letter. I do occasionally write a letter, and I have received some very good responses to a few of the letters that I have written. But I had never written a letter about this particular thing, and I actually will not because of what came up to me the very rest of this day. So anyway, that's the first part of what happened. I'm there judging this silly name tag. So that evening, what happens is we go to the regional center for this big, very lovely, large program. Wonderful costumes. The monks are up there doing little scenes and some skits, we call them that. I don't know. Some little glimpses of certain things about the history and some of their rituals and all. And just really enjoying it. And then on this one particular dance, they do not wear any unusual costumes. They're there in their street clothes, which are the saffron-colored robes that they've been wearing all week long. And I'm looking, and I'm on second row there, and I look, and I see a name tag, one of the monks up there. And on my monk, Jean-Paul, is wearing his name tag that he's been wearing all week long. And I think, is this possible? Is my monk wearing his name? This is a very aesthetic, really wrong thing to do. During the intermission, I've got to go up there, and I've got to take off that name tag. That doesn't look right up there. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. And it was not until after the event that this it came to me, wow, this was a very, very powerful synchronicity that I created for myself in these less than 12 hours. Here, I had experienced in widely divergent religious traditions during, to them, sacred moments in a presentation. I had taken upon myself to judge the aesthetics of what I was looking at, in that both of them had what I judged a misplaced and aesthetically distracting name tag. Now, that was pretty specific and pretty dramatic, and said to me, hey, maybe you're not in charge of all the name tags on all the performers in all the religions throughout the entire world. Maybe you don't have to be responsible for what you consider the aesthetic gaffes of these performances that you're looking at. Why don't you just relax? Just relax. So I did. Now, that was a good message to me that day. I didn't have the word jury duty in my mind, but I'm going to bring up the word jury duty with myself, I think, for the rest of my life, because that's a pretty good image for me. Okay, here's another, what I thought was a wonderful story that has to do with church stuff. See, this was about a year and a half ago. My friend Roseanne, who was sitting here, she and I were talking about going over to San Ramon to the ashram of the Hindus there to see Mother Amachi, who was visiting from her home in India. She is considered by millions to be a holy woman. And her American headquarters is in San Ramon, and a couple of times a year she comes there. So they had a whole week retreat set up for her followers, and I'd been told that it's a wonderful experience just to go over and get this hug that she gives to people who line up, and she says a little blessing and just 20-30 second hug. And so I thought, well, that would be a nice, lovely thing to do. So Roseanne and I were about to do it, and I was going to call to find out when. So as I got the person on the phone, she said, I'm sorry, we just had a fire here, and we're closed down. We had a kitchen fire, and everything shut down. If we'll be open for anything tomorrow, we don't know. You'll have to just call and see. So I hung up, and I thought, oh, gee, I'm sorry. That's really too bad. So I went to bed that night thinking, gee, you know, bless the Hindus. I hope they get that straightened out. And I thought, I don't remember noticing a synchronicity today. Then as I was drifting off to sleep, I remembered I had spent that morning doing some rewriting on my musical play, The Order is Love. Some of you may know this. It's really a very good Mormon musical on life in the United Order in Orderville. And the scene I had been rewriting that morning was a scene in which the dining hall burned down, and this blacksmith comes in to make the announcement. And from that time on, the group does not eat together in the dining hall. But I go into what I call my synchronicity space, just kind of this woo-woo kind of, oh, that's interesting, when these two things come together, you know, in a focus where the two things are no longer over here and here, but they move like this and they're one. And I look at them through each other, and I said, wow, ooh, that's interesting, isn't it? In one day, I experience the Mormon tradition of this kitchen fire by my writing about it, of this Mormon ashram, Orderville, these people trying to work toward a community of love, and also I experience a kitchen fire of the Hindus today, right next door to me, of the Hindus trying to have this communal experience of love, and two kitchen fires shut down business for them both. Woo, that's kind of big. So I think about that, and the next morning as I'm doing my meditation and thinking about that, and by this time I am long used to saying, okay, now am I supposed to be doing anything about that? And on this occasion, I'm meditating, and I say, okay, the Mormons, the Hindus, what's the meaning of this? Okay, finally, there are no Mormons, there are no Hindus. We're all one. Yes, we're all subject to the vicissitudes of life. We all have fires. Okay, yeah, anything else? Well, yeah, here the Hindus are without a place to meet. The Mormons ought to help the Hindus. So I jump up from my meditation, and I run to the phone, and I cancel my chiropractic appointment, and I call the ashram, and I say, hey, what are you guys doing about your facilities? Can you be able to, well, they don't know, the fire departments, we're trying to see if we can do anything, or if they're going to shut us down, we're looking into a hotel, we're looking into schools. And I said, would you be interested in having me just check about something about some churches? Oh, that would be great. So I spend the whole day on the phone, and by the end of the day, I have talked to two or three stake presidents, three or four bishops, two or three public relations people, every one of whom was 100% supportive of my suggestion. And I had, by the end of the day, received permission, depending on certain particular things, to offer them for their big event on Sunday, the Oakland Interstate Center, and or for other things, a couple of chapels in San Ramon and even my chapel in Walnut Creek, if that might happen to be the best thing. Now, the next morning, as I called and spoke again to the gentleman over the ashram, he told me that the fire department had finally given them permission to stay on the premises. And so they did not have to move. But he said, would you please come over so we can meet you and thank you. So I jumped in the car, and I went over to their evening thing, and there were about, I don't know, 600 Hindus there, and up in front was Mother Amici doing her ecstatic chanting and throwing of her arms in the air. And after that part of it was done, we lined up to get our little blessing. And I went up to meet the man that I had been speaking to on the phone. And he said, oh, come here. I want to introduce you. So he kind of broke into the line and introduced me to the Amici and through a translator, told her that I was the Mormon lady who had been trying to find a place for them and that had been successful, and the Mormon people were offering their facilities. And so she spoke and was translated back to me to say, thank you so much. Tell everyone who has been working on that I thank them and I bless them. And they have shown the highest form of service, which is love. So tell them that I bless them. And then she gave me my little hug and my little tapping on my head, my little blessing. And it was a very sweet, sweet motherly thing. So I got to go home and call all these excellent priesthood brethren and tell them they had just been blessed by the Divine Mother. Oh, and I didn't emphasize for you, she is indeed regarded by her followers as the earthly manifestation of the Divine Mother. So as I told that, and I left the message on some machines, so pleased with myself, and I spoke to others, so pleased to say, you have just been blessed by the Divine Mother. And they all received it very graciously. And my state president, in fact, was rather disappointed that we were not able to be of service in giving them the Interstate Center. That moment, as I thought about it, became bigger and bigger and bigger, in that here was this Hindu woman, Amici, that millions revere as a manifestation of the Divine Mother. Here's this little Mormon woman in Walnut Creek, Carolyn Pearson, who has spent much of her adult life trying to bring back the concept of the Divine Mother into the world, most particularly in her own Mormon community. And here, not in that symbolic kind of a metaphorical way, but in a very specific physical way, I had spent those 2 days trying to find a place for the Divine Mother within the Mormon Church, physically. And not only that, I succeeded. And just because it didn't actually happen the way we were trying to move it toward, that's beside the point. The event happened. The Mormons opened their chapels to the Divine Mother. And the Divine Mother blessed the Mormons. That's way good. That's way good. Now, there's just one more little tweak. Oh, well, there's another fun little thing. As I had left the message with my state president's wife, saying, I've got to talk to him as soon as he comes in and call me. And I waited all afternoon. He hadn't called. And it was 6 o'clock, and I thought, I hate to call again, but I've got to. So I called and got her and said, and she said, yes, I gave him your message, and he's here, and I'll get him. But at that moment, my call waiting beeped, and I thought, I can't take it. I'm waiting for my state president, but if I don't, what if I... So I got the call waiting, and... Hi, this is state president. And so it was my state president calling from a different phone in his home at the moment that I had called him. His wife was going to find him. So that's how, you know, synchronicity brings together in the exact second sometimes these related things. Now, as a final thing, the first woman who told me about the Amici, flew back to her home in Idaho. And as I was busy making all my phone calls around this project, one of the calls that came through, I got a call from her in Idaho. And she said, oh, Caroline, I just wanted you to know, I read this interesting thing on the literature about Amici on the airplane as I came home. Did you know that she was born on your very birthday, on September 27th? And I thought, wow, that's cool. That's neat. One with the Divine Mother. I will accept that. Okay, let's see. What are other of the stories? Do you have any questions to this point? You don't have to ask any questions. Maybe at the very end, if we have some time, you can think of something. But, you know, I've only got about 53 other stories to share with you, so just please just stay where you are. Okay, how about... Oh, you will love this one. Oh, this is Wally's Tie. You will love Wally's Tie. this happened just this very last Christmas. And yes, I'll get permission from everybody whose name I use in this book. Okay, Wally is this sweet man in my ward. Huge bear of a man. Could not be more unlike me in our political and religious, philosophical, cosmological stance. But while I am in... My car is parked outside in the parking lot with this little bumper sticker that reads, "Feminism is the radical notion that women are people." And while it's sitting, I am inside saying equally radical things. And it's going to surprise so many of you to know that my ward loves me. Roseanne, is this true that my ward loves me? So, Wally and I have had a few run-ins. Particularly around a talk I gave in Sacrament Meeting. 8 years ago? Gosh. Golly, Wally. so... Anyway, I won't go into all that, but he is a very dear man, and he has done some very sweet things for me and my children. And over the course of the years, I have developed a really authentic affection for Wally. And in spite of his suspicions of me, Wally likes me too. So we have this nice thing going, and we often hug in the foyer. Okay, this is the Sunday before Christmas, and I go to church, and directly after sacrament meeting, as I'm getting ready for church, I decide to be a little bit festive, so I put on this nice cranberry-colored knitted blouse and some dangly earrings that I don't often wear that are cranberry color that match the blouse. So I go to church, and we have a nice, wonderful choir program. And after the program, I go up front to speak to one of the women I visit teach, Carmen, to ask if she and her daughter would like to come over on Christmas Eve. And she says, yes, that would be wonderful. And then she says, Carolyn, I love those earrings. Oh, I love those earrings. Now, this is not something I ordinarily do, but I just reached up and I pulled out these little cranberry dangly earrings and I put them in her hand and I said, Carmen, Merry Christmas. Enjoy these earrings. Really? Yeah. Oh, gee, thanks. So I leave the front of the chapel there where I had my interaction with Carmen. I go out into the foyer. I see Wally and my former Bishop Craig standing there speaking, and I have to go speak to Craig about something. So I go up, and I fax to give Wally a hug, and he looks at me, and he says, Sister Pearson, I love that blouse you're wearing. If you ever want to get rid of that blouse, give it to me, because I'd love to make a tie out of that blouse. And I look way, way up at him, and Wally! And Craig already knows my synchronicity speak, because he and I have had some conversations. I say, Wally, we just did a synchronicity. Carmen just told me how much she loved my earrings, and I gave them to her, and now you're telling me how much you love my blouse, and I say, go like this. So we laugh, and I leave church in my car, and I'm just giggling. And if we're not so ingrained with looking at my synchronicities for suggestions of how to behave in my life, I would have just thought, wasn't that funny? But I always say, is there something that this is suggesting that might be an interesting thing to do? So I drove right to Roseanne's house, and she wasn't home. I found her later that night. And so the upshot of this is, Monday night, I am at Roseanne's house, having said to her, Roseanne, how to make a tie. She said, yeah, I used to make them all the time for my boyfriends back in New City. So we are there with my... I brought the show and tell because I'm collecting a museum of Carolyn Pearson synchronicities. So I have this big box that I put them into. So this is the remnants of my excellent cranberry-colored blouse. And so we get out there, and Roseanne says, are you sure you want to do this thing? And she, somebody else that I also told the story, don't you like the blouse? Is that the reason we give away things, is because we don't like them? No. So snip, yes, here we cut out this blouse. Cut the tie, she got her husband's a pattern, so we cut the tie out. And I'm at the machine doing the sewing. Roseanne is supervising. And I said, this has to be a very, very long tie because my Wally is a very tall man. So we make this tie. We put it in this nice little box, and we're just giggling the whole time because it is such fun. And so we take it up to Wally's house, knock on the door. He comes to the door. He and his wife are wrapping presents. They're going to go to Utah. I hand him this. They give us a little cookie. He opens up the box and he sees a tie. Oh, isn't that nice? And then it hits him. Oh, you didn't. Oh, this isn't. Oh. I said, yes, Wally. This is your tie for my blouse. So he just is speechless. Absolutely, totally speechless. And in a minute, these little tears come down his big cheeks. So I know that when my poems are long forgotten, Wally's great-grandchildren will be talking about Sister Pearson's tie. And the way I write that up in the story is kind of the fun thing about a family tie. Yes, Wally and I share a nice family tie. Now, I have to tell you the sister story to that story, which happened right in the middle of that story. And I do mean exactly right in the middle of that story. I'm up at Roseanne's house on the Monday evening, thinking that we will finish this whole project and deliver the tie before we go down to do our Monday event. And for the better part of a year, Roseanne and I have on Monday night gone into Concord to a residential home for deeply troubled adolescent girls. Roseanne and I both are drama women. She's the drama teacher at an intermediate school. And so we were trying to think of some significant way to try to do something meaningful of a community nature. This is what we finally came to. So we have gone to this home where there are six girls, each of whom is, believe me, very deeply troubled from all kinds of abuse and difficult behavioral situations, and theoretically do drama with them. Sometimes it's just, you know, kind of being with them and rubbing their shoulders and talking about this and that, and but trying to do some kind of coming out of themselves drama sort of work. So on the Wally's tie Monday evening, we supposedly were going to be able to finish all that and then go down. But we didn't finish, so we said, okay, that's easy. We'll just leave this here. We'll go down, do our time at with the girls, and then come back and finish the tie and take it up, which is what we did. But as we are down with our girls at what's called Anderson House there, well, thinking about Deja. And she had come some weeks prior wearing only the clothes on her back. And Roseanne had taken her out to get socks and underwear, and I had taken her to a thrift store to get clothes. So I'd gotten to know her a little bit, and she loved this huge bunch of clothes that I got her for $35. And so that was the last time I had seen her. So now on the Wally's tie Monday evening, we go in and we do our our work with them. And at the end, I say, how's the clothes working out? Oh, they're good. I had loaned her something of mine for the dance, and she was going to go back to me, so I went to her room with her, and she showed me this closet full of this stuff. And she said, oh, except for this one, see how the colors in it ran, because I made a mistake, and I washed it with... And she showed me a very pretty cranberry red three-quarter length sweater. And I said, oh, that's a really pretty sweater, Deja. That's really pretty. And she looked at me, she said, oh, do you want it? And I was just taken aback, and I said, oh, no. Do you like this sweater, Deja? Yeah, and somebody else had given it to her from somehow. And I said, oh, no, you keep it. You keep it. You need that sweater. So we're driving home, and I say, Roseanne, something so weird just happened. Here we are in the middle, in the exact middle of having such fun making this tie for Wally out of my cranberry red blouse that I really like. And right in the middle of that, this little girl, this very deeply troubled girl, Deja, asks me if I want to have this cranberry red sweater of hers. And I say, no. Deja has asked to join the party, and I tell her to go away. What is wrong with this picture? So I decided, and the next time we went down to the home there, after we finished whatever we were doing, I said, Deja, I want to tell you something. So we sat on the floor, and I said, have you heard about synchronicities? No. Well, the meaningful coincidences. And you know what happened last time when I was here? And, you know, we went about the clothes. And so I told her about Walt's tie, and she thought that was funny. And then I said, now, do you remember about that cranberry red sweater? And what when I said yes, it was very pretty, and you asked me if I... Oh, she remembered, yes. And I had said, no, you keep it. I said, well, Deja, you know, I was wrong not to accept that sweater from you. So if you would like still to give me that sweater, I would be really honored to have it. Oh, really? She jumped up, and we went to her room, and she took out this nice cranberry red sweater and gave it to me, and I put it on. And it's really good on me, doesn't it? Really, really does. So, okay, boy, there are layers and layers of meaning and all that. Plus, it's fun to be the giver, and it's usually so much easier to be the giver, and sometimes it's not as easy to be the receiver. But everyone needs to be able to give whatever it is that they have to give, and to allow someone who doesn't have very much to give to you is a great gift to them. So all these layers of meaning for my life that I can probe as I experience all the synchronicities that, believe me, almost every single day appear in my life, and that I promise you will appear in your life. Everyone that I speak synchronicity to starts bringing me stories. Roseanne has amazing ones. Susan gets them all the time. Dorothy gets them. I mean, we all get them. And you know what? You are now cursed. From this moment on, every day you're going to say, ooh, what was that? And it will be your own private message from the universe that has to do specifically with whatever it is that your life is about, and whatever it is that you, in that exact moment, need to be looking at. I do want to read to you one. Oh gosh, I was going to read that one too. I'll just tell you about it. This is so good. Then I'll read the last one. I brought one more show and tell. This little Valentine. One of my stories in here is the section is called Emily Dickinson. Now I have this interesting connection with Emily Dickinson. I am not even 1% of the writer that she was. But nevertheless, she and I have a strong connection. And she has popped up in some synchronistic ways in my life that are very dramatic. And well, I can tell you just really fast about, there's a young gay, well, I think he's young, I think he's still in his 30s, a gay man of all the many, many Mormon gay men who have contacted me over the years. He called me on the phone maybe 3 years ago for the first time to ask me to tell him why he should not kill himself. And so we have spoken on the phone from time to time. And he is also a schizophrenic and has been disowned by his family. And you'll be pleased to know, though, that the bishop of his, though he does not attend, and he's not in a relationship with anybody, the ward has been, confused as they are, has been helpful sometimes with food, with rides, and the Relief Society, I think it's the president, could be one of the counselors, he tells me frequently, has been really very sweet to him. At any rate, on a particular day, my son John, who's 30 years old and is staying with me for a while, he's doing freelance work. He's an animator for The Simpsons. And he and I have been having evening inspirational thoughts that I just love. So I grabbed a thought from The Course in Miracles, which is one of my favorite texts. And the thought that I had grabbed was, perfect love casts out fear. If fear exists, then there is not perfect love. But only perfect love exists. If there is fear, it produces a state that does not exist. Now, that will make sense to you if you study the text as I have. But the message is, only love is real. So I had chosen that morning to share with my son that evening. That day, and this was the day after Valentine's Day, I got a Valentine from this young man that I mentioned to you. And it's this little Valentine, and it just reads, "That love is all there is all we know of love," Emily Dickinson. And I thought, oh, here's a sweet thing from Emily Dickinson. And do you know what? That's, as I grabbed that thought that evening from the course, I said, ooh, that's just like the Valentine I got in the mail. So I thought, yeah, right, the course says only love is real. Emily says that love is all there is all we know of love. Now, you may not really believe this, but it was 3 weeks later, as I was thumbing through my manuscript, preparing it to send to somebody, that I realized that the last thing in my Emily Dickinson section that I had chosen of all the thousands of words of Emily Dickinson to sort of thank her, I had written down, "Love is all we know of love," and two lines. And then just a while later, in the mail, I received, via my sweet gay young man friend in Denver, I had received those exact words from Emily Dickinson, "That love is all we know of love." And when I realized that I had written those words just a little bit before, my little electric synchronistic shocks just went through me, and I thought, that is just so big and so good, and I am so, so grateful. I'm reading you now the final piece in this book. And I titled this Gratitude. Yesterday I finished writing the introduction to this book. All other sections were written, and this would be the last piece. Knowing, however, that writing is really rewriting, acting is reacting, learning now that vision is revision. Such fun to create a beginning for this book. So fun to write the final words. More than ever before, the universe has my attention and my gratitude. I blew out my writing candle and went downstairs. My home teachers from church were coming for their monthly visit. David and Diana McClun, my internationally famous quilter friend, who last year had gifted me with dozens and dozens of hours to help me make the amazing quilt I'd given to my son John for Christmas. A bit cold downstairs, light the fire, turn on the Tiffany lamps, answer the doorbell, handshakes, hugs, chit-chat by the fire, warmth, laughter. Our message this month, said David, is gratitude. Ah, yes, gratitude. That was the last word I had written just minutes before. A discussion of that good subject, more chit-chat by the fire, warmth, laughter, a prayer, another handshake, another hug,